All right, I think we're ready to begin. Good morning. I hope everyone is having a good Sunday morning so far. And I want to say something here at the beginning to the mothers. I hope you are having and will continue to have a good Mother's Day. This particular Mother's Day is probably a bit strange, probably a bit more deserved maybe than previous. And what I mean by that is the previous Mother's Days are, of course, deserved as well, but maybe this one especially so. That's probably a better way to put it, because of the additional difficulties surrounding the coronavirus and the things that, mothers and fathers have been asked to do is especially difficult here lately. So some of you certainly know what I'm talking about. And so I hope you have a good day and it's everything you want it to want it to be. Okay, so let's get back into Hebrews 11. And as I have repeatedly said about this chapter, this is arguably the most well-known section of Hebrews overall. But as I've also said repeatedly, this prompts us for this study to ask a question: what is it doing here? Why is chapter 11 such an integral part to the rest of the book? I mean, on the one hand, you could take Hebrews 11 out and the rest of the book would make perfect sense. But on the other hand, he spends a lot of time talking about these various examples of faith. And I think there's a very good reason for that. And by the way, I don't think it's a particularly difficult question to answer, but I do want us to continue to think about that question. And why is Hebrews 11 so important to what he's been saying through the rest of the book? Okay, so let's pick up in verse 13 of Hebrews 11. Now remember, he has been talking about Abraham, and he's going to continue to talk about Abraham. But Hebrews 11, 13 through 16 is a bit of an interlude where he explains what Abraham and the other patriarchs and matriarchs were doing with regard to faith. So he says, "These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having the knowledge that they were strangers and exiles on the earth." And we said that on Thursday, we said that this verse refers to the fact that the promises weren't fulfilled during their lifetime. They didn't see the promises come to fruition. And the other thing that I pointed out that I think is a consequence of this verse and the other verses we've looked at is that the faith that they had was not in their own ingenuity and in their own ability to make the promises come to pass. The faith is strictly in God. And I use an example of maybe an art project that when we start out, it doesn't look so great, but we are confident enough, we have enough faith in our own abilities to make it into something beautiful later on. That was the analogy that I used, which is certainly not one from experience. It's one from the experience of others. That's not this, right? This is strictly confidence in what God will do and can do and promised he will do. And I think that's the powerful aspect of this. Verse 14, "For people who speak thus make it clear that they're seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking that of the land in which they had gone out, they would have opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he's prepared for them a city." And so again, we see that they desire a better country, a heavenly one. And I talked about how last time, this is another idea that's particularly relevant for us when we look at how messed up the world is. And remember, I said that that was the case before the pandemic that we're currently enduring. It was already messed up. It has been messed up for a very long time. But I think it's probably easier to see, easier to recognize now, because we have access to so many kinds of media. And so this verse should ring very relevant or very true for us even today as well. All right. So those, that's, as I said, the interlude during Abraham's section. There are three sections, or I'm sorry, the section of Abraham can be divided into three parts, and then with the interlude before the third and final part. So this is the third and final part about Abraham. And we said, of course, that Abraham is an example of faith in a lot of places in the New Testament, James 2, Romans 4, Galatians, I believe it's Galatians 3. So we see Abraham is used many, many times in the New Testament, but also outside the New Testament as an example of faith. So it's not difficult to see why Abraham is chosen to be this example. However, what we will see later on, very shortly, is some of the examples that the writer of Hebrews uses are surprising. And if we were to list a catalog of faithful individuals from the Old Testament, I wonder if we would put the same people in here. And so that brings up the question, why does he include them? And we'll get to that in a minute. But let's finish the section on Abraham. So verse 17, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. And so that takes us through the entire book of Genesis. The things he mentions in verses 21 and 22, or Genesis, what you find in Genesis 49 and Genesis 50, and those are the last two chapters. But let's back up to what, to a reference to what has to be one of the most difficult passages in the entire Old Testament, and that's the sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham. So let's, I did this a little bit on Thursday, and I want to do this again because I think it's very relevant to what he's saying here. Think about that Genesis narrative. And as I said last time, sometimes I've asked the question in various classes, what's Genesis about? And students are very quick to say creation. And that may be the first thing we think about when we think about Genesis. I mean, after all, that's the name that we have for the book, Genesis, a beginning, begotting, coming into existence. That's essentially what the word can mean. So we understand that. The first two chapters have to do with creation. But then you got Genesis 3 through 11, which deal with what's referred to as the primeval history. That's where you have the flood narrative, the Tower of Babel, etc. But then Genesis 12 through 50 is about the patriarchal narrative. It's about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the matriarchs who are important in that narrative. So what is Genesis primarily about? Well, it's not creation. It's this story. And so the writer talks about the most difficult part of that story. And the reason I say it's difficult, I mean, there are all kinds of questions that we could ask about Genesis 21. And if this were a class on Genesis, we would go through those. So I don't want to get sidetracked with those particular issues. But I do want to say one issue that is relevant here has to do with the way Genesis 21 functions in the narrative of Genesis 12 through 50. And I say 12, but really, excuse me, just a second. All right. I say Genesis 12, but at the very end of Genesis 11, you have this little note that says Sarah was unable to have children. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because in the very next chapter, Genesis 12, God gives Abraham promises that are completely dependent upon the fact that Sarah needs to be able to have children. So already in the narrative, there is tension. Tension from the fact that the promises demand offspring and from the fact that Sarah can't have offspring. And so what do you see? Well, you see Abraham and Sarah trying to take things into their own hands, right? They try to have a situation where the Egyptian handmaid, Hagar, has a son, Ishmael. And Ishmael is thought, okay, well, this is the logical way to handle this problem. He's going to be the heir. God says, nope, he's not going to be. So they wait and they wait and they wait. And then finally, in Genesis 20, we find out Isaac is going to be born. And he is born. And so you think, okay, the tension is solved. There's no more tension now. He's the one through whom the promises are going to come, and everything's sewed up neatly. And then you get to this chapter that's mentioned here in Hebrews 11, verse 17, and that's Genesis 21, where Abraham offers up Isaac. So you see, you go from this relief of the tension with Isaac being born, and to the very next chapter, God says, offer your only son. So when he says, and he does repeatedly in that chapter, offer up your only son, it's not just to add a personal touch. This is his only son. He loves him, obviously. But it's also to say, here's the more tension. And when you ask the question, why? Why is that there? I think it's to reinforce the idea that you find throughout Genesis 12 through 50 that the promises only come about because of God. God's promises come to fruition in Genesis, or rather will come to fruition in Genesis, only because of God's power in spite of human weaknesses. I think that's what's going on here. And I think the writer of Hebrews, when he mentions this, by faith Abraham does this, reinforces that notion. Because you see, when you're not in control of the situation, you have to have faith in somebody who is in control of the situation. And this is something that, just from a personal perspective, that I need to get better at, is not being frustrated when I'm not in control. I mean, I'm like a lot of people. I like being in control. And so when I'm not, I get very frustrated. But for one thing, from a logical point of view, there's nothing you can do in many of those situations. But on the other hand, you have to have faith that God will take care of it. And that's exactly what this is about. That's what verse 19 is about. That regardless of how this incomprehensible command that God gives to Abraham, regardless of how awful that is, Abraham believed everything's going to work out. And you see that in the narrative. And of course, you see it here as well. Now, I want to say this in passing. I thought about mentioning this in much more detail, but really don't have to do that. It's not relevant here. But one thing that is maybe a little surprising, if you're familiar with the literature, is how restrained this summary of the Abraham and Isaac narrative is. In Jewish tradition, this is called the Akedah. And the Akedah is really about that story, but also the traditions that grow up alongside of it. Because if you read Genesis 21, it is amazingly sparse on conversation. Right? I mean, when God asks Abraham to offer his son, the reader expects Abraham to say, "What? You want me to do what? Why? Why could you? How can you ask this?" There's none of that. There's nothing, all or almost nothing, between Abraham and Isaac. I mean, and on and on and on it goes. There's an essay, a very famous essay about this subject by Auerbach. It's called Odysseus's Scar, and you can find it online if you're interested. But what it does is it compares the narrative technique of Homer, because in the Odyssey at the very end, at the very moment where Odysseus's identity can be revealed to his household, Homer takes a break and explains this scar, which is what's going to identify Odysseus, and he takes several hundred lines to explain how he got this scar. And then you compare that with Genesis 21, where there's almost nothing. It's incredible. It's a very interesting essay, in my opinion, very well known about this subject. But that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what has been written about that chapter. There are crazy narratives in later Jewish tradition, the Targums, for example, the Aramaic translations of the Old Testament. A lot of times, particularly in certain versions of that, there it's not just translation, it's interpretation. And one narrative says that the reason that Isaac, or Jacob rather, is blind in his old age is because, it's Isaac is blind in his old age is because when this happens, the angels are weeping and angel tears get into his eyes. And that's why he's blind later on. Of course, Genesis has nothing like that. Neither does Hebrews. So I want to stop there. Well, let me mention one more thing. If you're interested in the Jewish traditions associated with Abraham's offering of Isaac, there's a very interesting book that gives a history. Some of it goes even to more modern interpretations, and it's called The Last Trial by Shalom Spiegel. It's an older book, but it's still very valuable. And some of it's just, I mean, it's incredible, the traditions that are associated with that chapter in Genesis. Okay, so now we'll go to verse 19. And it says that Abraham considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. Now, I don't think that he's referring to specifically the notion of resurrection here. I think that would be a little bit strange, because you can ask, you can see that in Genesis, there's no mention of resurrection. And so I think he's probably saying here, bring him back from the dead. Abraham's faith extended even to that. And I think that's certainly true. We see that Isaac also invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau, and then we see Jacob blessing each of the sons, and then by faith Joseph. This is a remarkable part of the chapter, because he does mention that chapter. Do you remember what God says to Abraham? As he's got the knife ready, he's about to offer his son. Do you remember what he says? He says, now I know. God says, now I know that basically you have faith in me. That's what he says. Now, of course, I think what that is doing is letting the reader know. Now the reader knows that Abraham has that kind of faith. Okay, I know I said a lot about that, but I think it's obviously important for various reasons. So before we go on, any questions or comments about that? Okay, well, now we move to Moses. And Moses' story here, I think, is a little bit easier. There are some things here that are said about Moses that aren't explicitly stated in the Exodus narrative, but I do think they're very logical. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch him. So now, of course, this extends from the very beginning of the book of Exodus through the actual narrative about the Exodus from Egypt itself. Now, so you're talking Exodus 14, and then you got the Song of Moses, Exodus 15. One thing that is worth asking is verse 26. The reproach of Christ, what does that mean exactly? I think there are generally two interpretations, and they don't have to necessarily be mutually exclusive either. One of which is Moses was kind of a prophet, which of course he had that role, and he could see into the future and see the actual reproach of Christ prophetically. And therefore, he decided, I'm going to share in that kind of persecution that Christ received in my own day. Now, I've kind of put them together because the other possibility is that he shared the kind of suffering that Christ had. Okay, so they are different, but as I said, they could easily fit together. Moses... it could be that there's nothing stated here about the prophetic idea that Moses saw the reproach of Jesus, but rather Moses participated in the same kinds. So those are the options. I don't really know which it is. I guess if I had to commit, it would probably be the latter, that he... there's nothing really prophetic here necessarily, but rather that he suffered the kind of thing that Christ did, and that is suffering for the sake of righteousness. And here, greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Okay, verse 26 again mentions this idea of looking to the future, and that's already a theme that we've seen over and over again in this chapter, is that these individuals aren't living in the moment exclusively. And that's something that I think we have to balance as believers, is that we have to realize we have certain obligations, we have certain responsibilities, and there's a certain value to living life in the moment. But on the other hand, we have to look toward the future, because that's when God is going to make all of these things right. And I say all of these things, including all the things that are unjust, God's going to make that right. And that includes our eternal home. And that includes the blessings that go along with that, that we can't even comprehend at this stage in our existence. So, that I think, again, there's in the New Testament, I think this fits well with the idea of the New Testament, that our salvation is now, but it's also not yet, right? There's an aspect for sure that we are saved right now, but the ultimate fulfillment is later on. And I think sometimes you can talk to people, or you hear people talk about always looking to the future. You know, I'm thinking about the hymn, "This World Is Not My Home." Now, just by mentioning that hymn, I know that's a favorite hymn of a lot of people, and I'm not saying anything about it specifically, but I am saying that hymn could give you the idea that since this world is not my home and I'm just passing through, that I really don't have to take any, let me back up, that since I'm just passing through, I don't really have to pay much attention to what's going on here and now. And I think that's going a little bit too far. And I don't really think that's what the song is saying anyway. But it can give you that impression. But we have to realize that we have responsibilities here and now. We have things to think about here and now in our efforts to be faithful. But we are always having, you might say, one eye toward heaven for sure. So that's a theme that you see over and over again in Hebrews 11, is these individuals are looking forward. They're doing what they need to do in their present day, but they're also looking forward as well. Okay, so that takes us through Moses' story. I want to get to this section especially, starting in about verse 31, because as I said at the beginning this morning, Abraham, not difficult to understand why he's included. Moses, not difficult. But beginning in verse 31, we start to see some individuals that are mentioned, and it's maybe difficult to see why. Okay, so let's read verse 29. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. Okay, nothing difficult. Summary of the actual Exodus event. And then verse 30, he skips to the book of Joshua. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. Again, nothing difficult about that. That event certainly required faith. And then we get to verse 31, and we find a surprise person who's mentioned. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. Okay. Why is Rahab mentioned? And notice she's referred to as the prostitute. The writer of Hebrews knows the narrative about Rahab. And so he's not trying to hide the fact that she's a prostitute. Now, if you compare verse 31 of Hebrews with what Josephus says, I think it's really interesting. So here, Josephus in the Antiquities, book 5. So just very quickly, Josephus is the Jewish historian living toward the end of the first century AD. So he's writing after the book of Hebrews probably, but they're pretty close contemporaries. Josephus in books 1 through 13 of the Antiquities of the Jews, he recounts the Old Testament story. Now, if you've never read that, it takes a while, but it's very interesting because at the very beginning of the Antiquities, and he does this elsewhere, Josephus says, I'm retelling the Old Testament story. That's how we would put it. I'm retelling the Old Testament story, and I'm not adding or taking away anything. And yet, you see passages like this where he takes things away. You see other passages where he has significant additions that, and hopefully if you've been with me throughout this class, you might wonder, well, are some of those additions because Josephus is using the Septuagint? Because Josephus, like the writer of Hebrews, is writing in Greek. He clearly knows Greek. Well, some of them aren't in the Septuagint. So how can he say that? Scholars have debated how Josephus can actually say something like that and then blatantly do the very thing he says he's not going to do. So something's going on there. We're not entirely sure what he means by that. But at any rate, this is what he says about Rahab. But in the evening, they retired to a certain inn that was near to the wall in order to eat their supper, which supper, when they had eaten and were considering how to get away, information was given to the king as he was eating supper that there were some people who had come from the Hebrews' camp to view the city as spies, and that they were in the inn kept by Rahab and were very interested that they might not be discovered. Now, he goes on and he says a couple of other things about the narrative that are in the biblical account, but he talks about Rahab again. But whenever he talks about Rahab, he calls her an innkeeper. He never refers to her as a harlot. Now, I suspect that Josephus is doing this because he knows the problem of referring to her as a prostitute. He knows that's a bit of a problem because she clearly is someone who does the right thing in Joshua. There's no question about that. But Josephus wants to make it a little bit easier to deal with Rahab, and so he says, yeah, she's an innkeeper. She's not a prostitute. But of course, that's not what the writer of Hebrews does. He refers to her as a prostitute. Now, there are several things that are significant about this. Number one is that her profession, and I want to be careful how I say this, but her profession did not prevent her from being faithful to God. And I would say, all right, here's the problem, right? And here's the problem that I think Josephus wished to avoid, is that when you see by faith Rahab the prostitute, you may think, well, how could she be faithful if she was a prostitute even then? I mean, for her, in order for her to be, we would say, completely faithful, she would have to cease being a prostitute. Well, things were more difficult with regard to that. We don't know really anything else about Rahab, but if she had chosen this as a way to make a living, it meant she was a very low-class citizen, and I say class in an economic sense, but also in a moral sense as well. She would have been viewed that way. Prostitutes were viewed that way in the ancient Near East. But it could be that her male relatives had died, and this is the only way to survive. Now, I'm not excusing what she did, but that's one way to perhaps look at what she's doing. But we don't even have to do that, really. Because I think this is an important principle that we see in verse 31 and in other examples that he's going to bring up a little bit later, is that the question is, was Rahab faithful in this situation? And the answer is yes. And that's all that matters for the writer. Is in this specific instance, she was faithful, period. And I think that's probably the easiest way to solve this dilemma. You know what else is interesting, though? You know where else Rahab is mentioned? In the very first chapter in the New Testament, in Matthew chapter 1, in the genealogy of Jesus, Rahab is mentioned. And I think the reason for that in Matthew is very different than here, okay? But I do think that's perhaps one way to explain this. And that's actually what I'm reading a private message now that someone sent to me, and that's what this person mentioned as well, that Rahab is mentioned with other women. And like I said, I do think that's a little bit different reason there. But yeah, that's absolutely correct that she's mentioned in connection with Jesus himself. I think in Matthew chapter 1, it's to show that that Jesus can save even people in his own lineage who were obviously less than perfect. Okay, so now we get into some others that are mentioned that are perhaps a little bit surprising. What more shall I say? For time would fail me. All right, so that is a rhetorical move to let the reader know I'm not going to go into detail about this. I will mention them in passing, but we really just don't have time to talk about the specifics of their deeds of faith. And so he mentions Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah of David and Samuel, and the prophets. All right, let's stop there because we already have some difficulties. Now, of that list, you might say, okay, David, absolutely. Was David a man of faith? Yes, of course, he was. Was he perfect? No, far, far from it. In fact, when I teach Old Testament history and geography, which I've done the past 3 years, when we get to the section about David, it bothers me, it seems like, every year, more and more when I teach that section. So, but at any rate, again, was he faithful in various aspects of his life? The answer is yes. Okay. Gideon is also a bit of an odd choice. Barak, who isn't mentioned very much, but Barak isn't particularly problematic like Gideon. And then we get to Samson. And I would say that out of all of these individuals, Samson is probably the most difficult. Because when you read the story of Samson from the book of Judges, this is not someone who you would say belongs in faith's hall of fame, right? Samson is not a likable figure. And when you read the narrative, it seems like Samson does things for the benefit of one person, and that's himself. But let's back up a moment, and this is how this is what I'll say about Samson and why I think he's mentioned here. And that is because in the book of Judges, I sometimes think about the book of Judges like the Wild West, right? And I say that because the refrain that you see in the book of Judges several occasions, I think it's three times, that everyone did what was right in their own eyes because there was no king in Israel. Okay, and if you've read the book of Judges, you may be familiar with the various judges, right? But if you read the end of it lately, the end of it, I think, is a pretty good way to think about the entire period. It is it's a mess. And so you might say the expectations of what being faithful were in the book of Judges maybe aren't the same as they are in other periods. So again, we come back to the question that we ask with reference to Rahab. Was Samson faithful in various aspects of his life? And the answer is yes, he was. Is he perfect? Far from it. But did he have faith in God in a difficult period, in a difficult circumstance? The answer is yes. Okay. Jephthah is another problem. All right. Jephthah's story, of course, has to do with sacrificing his own daughter. There are some people who think that he really didn't do that, and they interpret the text in sort of a symbolic sense that he sacrificed his daughter in the sense that he offered her to God as a servant, and therefore she would not ever marry. I don't think the narrative lends itself to that. I know that's an easier explanation, but I don't think that's what the text says. There's one particular way of looking at texts that I've heard over the years by people that I respect a great deal, and they will say something to the effect of, when you encounter a difficult passage in the Bible, you go with the least problematic interpretation. And I disagree with that. I think you go with the interpretation that does the most justice to what the text actually says and deal with the consequences. That's my opinion. And you're free, of course, to disagree with that. But I think that's doing the most justice to the text, is letting the text be the text and deal with the consequences. We may not like some of the consequences. I don't like the fact, for example, that Jephthah, I believe, did sacrifice his daughter. I don't like that, but I think that's what the text is saying. Again, though, is Jephthah someone who is faithful? And at times, and you say, yes, he is. Okay. Now, another possibility here is with these individuals mentioned in the book of Judges, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, that the author may not have had access to the full book of Judges. He just knew about summaries of the stories. And so maybe he was not aware of the difficult aspects of it. That's one possibility. Now, I realize that may not be something that we wish to entertain, because there's an assumption that the writers of Scripture in the New Testament had as much knowledge as we do now. Let me just say, I think that is an unwarranted assumption. And that doesn't do anything to the concept of inspiration. Inspiration doesn't demand that the writers know everything that's ever happened. It doesn't demand that. It instead demands that what they're saying is inspired by the Holy Spirit. And 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17 is the closest we get to an explanation of how inspiration works. So we don't know exactly how it works. But I can't find anything in Scripture that says the New Testament writers have to know every single thing that happened in Scripture before them. And I think from a realistic perspective, did the writer of Hebrews have the entire Old Testament canonical works at his disposal? Well, the way copies were made in antiquity, I would say that's highly unlikely. So all that to say, that's not impossible that he had these summaries about Gideon, Barak, and Samson. Now, from our perspective, again, it's maybe more problematic, but we can still see that these individuals were faithful at various points in their lives. And then he mentions David, Samuel, and the prophets. And let me just say a little bit about this, and then we'll have to stop. We're a little bit over time already. But Samuel is mentioned, and notice now we're out of order, right? Samson comes before David. And I think probably it could just simply be that he mentions David first, and then he mentions Samuel and the prophets, because Samuel, of course, was a prophet himself and seemed to be, in some sense, a teacher of prophets, is what you get in 1 Samuel 20, if I remember correctly. So I think maybe that's why. It's not difficult to see. Notice who's missing, and that's Solomon. Now, Solomon's story, of course, is very difficult because he started out very faithful. I would say that some of the most powerful prayers in the Bible are in the first few chapters of 1 Kings uttered by Solomon. But then, of course, we see that he was extremely unfaithful. And I think if Solomon were mentioned here, it would be maybe even more problematic. But we could still say the same thing, right? That Solomon was indeed faithful at certain points in his life. Verse 33 and following describes more specifically what these individuals did and others. And so, frankly, some of the things that are mentioned are a little bit difficult to find in the Old Testament. And in fact, I would say that they're not. Namely, verse 37, that they were sawn in two. You don't find that in the Old Testament. But I think here, again, as he does before, he's referring to a Jewish tradition. Okay, now, before we conclude, and we'll, of course, pick this back up on Thursday, and hopefully we'll be able to finish Hebrews 11 on Thursday. But before we do that, does anyone have any questions or comments before we conclude our class? Okay, well, I want to thank you again for your attention. Hope everyone has a good Sunday.